Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, as negotiations on a Palestinian bid for statehood take on a feverish pace at the UN in New York, we go to Jerusalem to hear from a local Catholic bishop his reaction. And today's hidden reality of human trafficking. We hear what women religious in the church are doing to try to stop it. Feverish negotiations are underway at the United Nations this week, either in support of or to block a Palestinian bid for statehood. President Mahmoud Abbas has vowed to present a request for international recognition of a Palestinian state to the 15-member Security Council Friday. A Security Council resolution could lead to admission of Palestinians to the UN as a non-member observer state, similar to the Holy See's own status. Currently, the PLO is listed as an observer to the UN. Well, what would statehood mean to the Palestinians, and how hopeful are they that their request will muster the support it needs? I put those questions to the Auxiliary Bishop of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, William Shomali, who says Palestinians will undoubtedly feel disappointed if the U.S. makes good on its vow to veto the measure.
Palestinians are well informed about what will happen at the General Assembly and at the Security Council. They know that they will pass as non-member state at the General Assembly because they have a majority of states, and they may not pass in the Security Council because of the American veto. They are already informed. Sure, they will be disappointed, but at least it is foreseen and not unpredictable.
So are there any expectations of any violence that might follow this vote at the UN?
We hope there will be no violence because Israelis and Palestinians, and also our communique as Christian bishops in Jerusalem, we invited everyone, Israelis and Palestinians, to restrain, to auto-control themselves and not to resort to violence, because it doesn't serve any interest for anyone.
What has being citizens of a non-state meant for Palestinians? I know that things most of us take for granted, like obtaining a passport and travel, are just some of the difficulties Palestinians face.
What is the result of being non-member state? They will continue to have the same passport. The passport is already in the hands of Palestinians. But what will change is that they can be members of many organizations of the UN, and also they can have recourse to the criminal court of La Haye in case there is any aggression against Palestinians. For example, if settlements are constructed illegally on Palestinian territories recognized as occupied, Palestinians can object. So far, if they go to object, they will be rejected because they don't have the statutes of members of a state.
Is a Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders realistic? Those borders are already recognized in the UN Security Council Resolution 242, and we've also seen Israel reject those boundaries time after time, including that 2002 Beirut declaration where Arab League member states agreed to peace with Israel in exchange for its recognition of those borders.
Yes. Many resolutions of the United Nations exist, but they are inefficient. But now, even Obama recognizes the importance of having a Palestinian state, even Paris here. But the question is that they don't want it to come as a result of a votation in the United Nations. They want it as a result of negotiation. So the statehood in itself is not contested by anyone, but the way of obtaining it is contested. This is it. Now, for the borders, I'm sure that Israel doesn't accept the borders of pre-June 67. Palestinians accept with the possibility of swap. Swap means, that they exchange territories as it is needed. So Palestinians accept the swap as it was suggested by Obama himself in his May speech.
Well, so do you see this UN bid for statehood as an attempt to force Israel's hand to get Israel back to the negotiating table?
Israel accepts to go, to come back from today to the negotiation table. The problem is not there. The problem for Palestinians is that so far negotiations failed, and they feel they need a strong platform on which to build the negotiations. If a platform is not existing, is not acceptable for both parties, it's useless to negotiate again, because the same negotiations, without having any platform like before, will fail again. And Palestinians don't want another 15 years of negotiation for a futile exercise. This is the reason Palestinians went to the UN, because of the failure of negotiations. But if Israel today presents a good platform, and you know what I mean, Palestinians may not really make a request to the United Nations, because they know they will obtain what they want through negotiations. Why not? They are ready for that even.
How do you think all of this, what's going on in New York, is going to impact continued Israeli settlement activity?
I don't know, really. It depends upon them. But I believe they will continue. I believe. But I don't know. I am not a prophet to say that they will restrain themselves from constructing new settlements. But it's a difficult issue here.
Also, the issue of Jerusalem is a very contentious issue. Both the Palestinians and the Israelis want it as their capital.
Yes. Now, first of all, let us settle the problem of the borders. When the borders are settled, everyone is free to say, this is my capital. So I don't want now to say what I think, but I think it's important, if we have two states, to have clear borders. When the borders are clear, everyone is free to say, Israelis are free to say, we want Tel Aviv to be our capital or Jerusalem. No one can impose on them. When the Palestinian borders are clear, Palestinians are free to say, we want it to Jerusalem or Bethlehem or Ramallah. So I don't want to interfere now in the decision of each one, but what is so urgent is to fix the future borders. Everyone knows I have here, but not beyond that. So this is very important, and this fixing the borders is the work of the United Nations, because it has jurisdiction on that.
Many of our listeners are based in the United States. What will this vote in the UN mean to the U.S.'s credibility in the Arab region, do you think?
I believe that the United States is losing credibility among its friends, like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and even Jordanians, Egyptians, Palestinians. We expect from the United States to be more working for real peace, real reconciliation, international law and justice, and to respect the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring, which is taking place even here in the territories. So I believe that it is the interest of the United States to be more credible. And the test of the credibility is this issue in a specific way.
And finally, Bishop Shomali, what are the hopes of Palestinian Christians there for what could be really a momentous time in their history?
You know, Palestinian Christians are in the same time Christians and in the same time Palestinians. They want in the same time political freedom, and in the same time they need religious freedom and freedom of conscience. This is what they are looking forward. We hope that this will be achieved soon. They need religious freedom. They have it already. We can say that in Israel and in Palestine, Christians are respected as so. We can't complain. We have full freedom of worshiping in our churches, in our schools, in our establishments. No one is objecting against that. So we don't have to expect more. Freedom of conscience, it's another problem, you know, in all the Arab countries. We have to convince Arabs of the importance for everyone to have freedom of conscience. For political freedom, it depends upon how will the negotiations and the voting in the UN will end. We pray for success because many things depend of the Lord, not only of diplomatic and political efforts.
And a warm thanks there to the Auxiliary Bishop of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, William Shomily. They're lured abroad by visions of prosperity, by hopes for a better future for their kids and families back home. Sometimes they're trying to escape war or conflict. Some 12 million people around the world today are believed to have become slaves for those dreams of a better, safer life. But their number could be even double that, as many as 27 million men, women, and children to live in a state of modern slavery. People like Tara from Ethiopia, promised a good job as a maid in the Middle East, who finds her passport confiscated and 20-hour days of humiliation and hard work. Or Umma from Somalia, who spends her last pennies for a boat ride to Italy, only to find herself an unwilling victim of the sex trade. Or Nobin, a fisherman from Bangladesh, beaten by his boss when he fails to meet his quota of catch for the day. Well, among the growing number of lay and religious organizations combating these forms of human trafficking is the Catholic International Union of Superiors General, or UISG, which in 2009 instituted the International Talitha Kum Network to train consecrated religious and lay in methods of prevention and assistance for victims of trafficking. At a recent Rome conference on trafficking, I spoke to Salesian sister Australia Castellone of Talitha Kum. She says the network takes its name from a center for trafficked girls that she helps run in her native Philippines.
Many times you get exasperated with their manifestations because sometimes they manifest their depression on what happened. But we are always pushed on by the words of Jesus, which says, "She is not dead." And Jesus himself raised this girl to life. So we take that as a message of hope for every trafficked girl, that no matter what she went through, it's not the end. She could be raised to life. So we take this word as our own to nurture our hope and desire that every man and woman and child who will be and who has been victimized by trafficking persons could be raised to a new life, could be restored to the dignity of the child of God that he or she is.
Talitha Kum is not just a name, Sister Australia tells me. It's the spirituality of hope that guides the sisters in their work.
There is hope for everyone who has been dragged into this circle, this criminal circle of trafficking in person.
Through their many hospitals, schools, and social centers around the world, Catholic sisters can play an important role in combating and preventing trafficking of persons and offering material, spiritual, and psychological help to victims. And in the 68 countries where it's located, Talitha Kum is training more and more religious for the job. It's a job, Sister Australia says, that puts us in touch with all forms of poverty, the material, the spiritual, and the moral.
In our mission, we touch with our own hands the horrors of trafficking in persons, talking to especially women and children, because UISG for the women congregation. The training course is aimed at enhancing the capacity of the sisters to address the issue and to maximize and share the resources which religious life has, because we have resources that can be put into action. One, such as we have structures, we have schools, orphanages, hospitals, clinics, social centers, and this could be very well, shall we say, put at the service, especially of victims and of the vulnerable persons first. And the other, the educative institutions are very effective venues for the prevention and awareness raising about this phenomenon.
While poverty is a contributing factor to human trafficking, by no means is it the only one. With more and more people migrating, the very concept of poverty has changed. Being poor today is not what it meant to be poor yesterday.
Now, poverty per se, as we see it, the material one, is not a cause, it's a factor that affects the spread, the unfolding of this phenomenon. Because right now, for example, there is material poverty, but there's also what we call the moral poverty, virtual poverty, whereas once upon a time, a person who has a house, a family, a piece of land to till, this person would not consider himself poor, and we would not consider this. Instead now, with this boom of migration, with human mobility, they compare themselves with others who maybe have members of their family in other countries, in prosperous countries, who could afford some luxuries. And so the values shift. Whereas the basic, the fundamental value of family and human relationships and community, sense of community, people are ready to live these values in exchange for material comfort, you know, a more comfortable house, the amenities of modern technologies. And this is one of the hooks of traffickers.
Here in Italy, there's quite a large Filipino community.
Yes.
And many of them are working as domestic
yes.
helpers in homes mm-hmm. and so on, or taking care of the elderly. And you hear so often stories of exploitation of these people who, you know, their employers are not treating them fairly yeah. by European standards. You also hear of very tragic stories of women, for example, who've come over from the Philippines
yeah.
and they're here for years before they're even able to get their papers in
yes.
order. And they finally arrive at getting their papers and find out that their husband and their children are no longer
yeah,
there or no longer waiting for them.
Touch, yeah.
So these are really touching issues which
yes.
people don't often think about.
This is what I was talking about. When you look at poverty, it's not only, we don't look at it only from the point of view of lack of material goods or material values, because there's a shift to this. In exchange for these material amenities, you have the crumbling of family values, for example. They say they come, they migrate, they leave their own country for another prosperous country in order to provide a future for their family. But when they go back, the family is not there anymore. This is what I mean to say by the other side of poverty, which seems that migration, this going to another country, would improve their lot. And yet, the phenomenon is complex. We cannot, in our work, we cannot take full hold of this reality. And this is why I am really very sold out to this idea of partnership, of networking with other sectors of the society.
To reach out to more victims of trafficking, Sister Australia and her fellow religious have established partnerships with other sectors of society, including NGOs and governmental lay institutions and networks. These have included the International Organization for Migration and the U.S. Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration.
These things, for example, will help us for a more effective service delivery. Partnering, for example, with IOM, they are in many countries. They have their offices there. They have mechanisms, machineries, and data about migration, which we share. And from the social point of view, they also have this flow. How is the flow of how is human mobility, for example, from Africa to Europe or from Asia to other parts of the world? And this way, we are informed first, and we can strategize our moves, our intervention.
You're talking about partnerships, but prevention is also such an extremely important part of it. How do you prevent women and children and young men from falling into the trap of human trafficking?
This is one of the skills we give during our course. We discuss with them three types of prevention: the primary, the secondary, and the tertiary. The primary would be, this would be more on awareness raising. This would be to give them enough, you know, prevention means to modify behavior or situation in such a way that the possibility of this contact with traffickers would be lessened, if not avoided. And then in the secondary prevention instead, if there is this contact and there is already this plan or the decision to leave the country, we give secondary prevention in a way that we give information on safe migration, the legal, shall we say, legislations addressing the issues of migration. This is where IOM helps us a lot. And partnership with legal agencies could help us a lot, you know, like assuring that certain recruiting agencies are legal and recognized and accredited by governments, because this is very important in the secondary intervention. And we inform them about proper documentation. You see, people could be sometimes deceived. They say, okay, we get your working permit when you reach the country. But we tell them, we give them, we conduct seminars for living nationals when they have to go. The tertiary is a bit, this is where we have to enter, because the tertiary is you prevent further harm for those who have been victimized already. And this is where we have shelters, we have halfway houses. These are part of our mission now. After the training courses in many places, centers or shelters for trafficked women and children have been put up by the sisters.
And this is all over the world?
This is all over the world. We have 20 members in 5 continents of the network.
How have you seen your work change the lives of women?
Well, for one, I think that the very first, the most impressive for me is the awareness of women about their own dignity. That nobody has the right to inflict harm on them. Because sometimes, many times, they blame themselves for what happened to them. Yeah, because I'm too ambitious. I was the one who dreamed of going away. But this does not excuse the traffickers or the criminals from taking advantage of their weaknesses and their dreams and shatter even this wholesome dream. So that's the first one. And from this awareness of their own dignity, I see that there is the empowerment. So their desire to improve their lot, their desire to do something. And here we are partnering with the other industries and agencies on providing for them healthy, shall we say, income-generating projects, giving them skills so that they can find a fruitful employment.
In their own countries.
In their own countries. Mm-hmm. In their own countries. At the same time, there are also among our members, for example, USMI in Italy is one of our members. They are working, they have advocacies on how to secure a better status for women who have been rescued from traffickers. You know, like, because many of them don't even have the passport. Sometimes the passport is the wrong name with their picture. So this, shall we say, securing a status, at least that they exist as persons. This one, for example.
What are your hopes for the world tomorrow?
You know, if we'd say that to see an end to trafficking in persons, maybe this could be a utopic hope, no? But my hope is that more and more would take this challenge, to put our positive energies in addressing trafficking in persons. that they would become aware, and becoming aware, the indifference would lessen, because many times, you know, when things are worse, they would suddenly wake up. I did not know. I seem to see her sometimes all full, all black and blue, but I did not know that she's being maltreated, you know, neighbors like that. Is that to for many more persons to join this pool of positive energies and network against this trafficking in persons? I would say, I used to say this to the sisters, trafficking in persons is a criminal network. To counteract this, we should put positive energies for a positive network of counteracting.
Do you think governments are doing enough? And also, I've noticed there's more of a push to get the private sector businesses involved in preventing human trafficking.
One of the things that I see as a sign of hope is that more and more governments have come up with anti-human trafficking laws. In Africa, I've been to Kenya just last month, and we saw this, that in Africa, more and more countries have come up with anti-trafficking laws. The problem is the promulgation, the actualization. Well, you have, for example, in our country where the anti-trafficking law has been since 2003, out of more than 3,000 cases presented to the court, there were only 19 convictions. So the law is very, very slow.
Sister Australia and her companions, working for an end to human trafficking, share one conviction: that every man, woman, and child is a child of God with an inherent human dignity.
We are all creatures of God, created in His image and likeness. And if we look at each other with this dignity, we cannot trample upon anybody. And therefore, we work so hard, we commit ourselves, so that this dignity could be promoted. And for those who have been so destroyed, that this could be restored to them. And that more and more, because it doesn't matter what your faith is, this is basic. This is basic. Not all of our girls are Christians, but they are persons. We address that point of God which lies within them. And this is where we preach the news. What's the news? God loves you. I think this is the beautiful news of evangelization. No matter who you are, no matter how you believe, God loves you. And I am a bearer of this love.
Sister Australia Castellone of the International Union of Superiors General and its anti-trafficking network, Talit Kum. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.